Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
That little Chico Pitbull, Mr. 305, but it said Mr. Worldwide. You already know what it is. Listen to my new podcast, From Negative to Positive. Subscribe today. Now, part of the things that we're doing over here at Negative to Positive is encouraging people to change their lives, change the things that are within their power. I want to thank our good friends at KFC for helping me bring this to you. Feed your whole crew with KFC. Let's go. I can get the KFC bucket of chicken, and you know, that's fire. Now, Babo, you know that you could get that mac and cheese, that mashed potato, gravy, those biscuits. Now, that's trouble right there. That is fire right there. You know, on Negative to Positive, we always talking about striving and achievement. And the Colonel Sanders story is a story that inspired me since I was 10 years old. Look how life comes full circle. Now I'm talking about Colonel Sanders and Kentucky Fried Chicken and how much I love it. Listen to my new podcast, From Negative to Positive. Check out the vodcast. Subscribe today. Apple Podcast, Podcast One, Spotify.
We begin today's meditation with a few sipping exercises to remind us a little treat can go a long way. So pick up your McCafe iced coffees, close your eyes, and deep sip in. And deep satisfaction out.
Take a treat retreat at McDonald's. Right now, get a McCafe iced coffee in any size and any flavor for just 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price of participation may vary.
John Rocha and Matt Nost are here to bring you the top 10.
Welcome, everybody, to a brand new episode of the Top 10 Show. I am John Rocha.
I am Matt Nost.
And today we are doing the top 10 underwater movies. We're doing this for what?
For underwater.
Yeah, just for underwater, the movie that Kristen Stewart's in. By the way, welcome to 2020 again.
Yes, welcome in. I hope you guys had a great holiday season and New Year's and all that jazz.
Yeah.
And thanks to everybody that's joining us for this start of the new year. We're excited. We've got all kinds of stuff coming out. If you've listened to the shows in previous weeks or for whatever reason you've been missing out and you're just jumping in here,
yeah.
We have two upcoming live shows that you guys can come out and see. February 29th at the House of Blues. We're doing two shows that night, 8 and 10 p.m.
That's right.
Tickets are $25 and $40 if you want to come to both. And then May 2nd, a Saturday in London, coming back to King's Place,
hello,
baby. We're doing an 8 o'clock. Tickets are £30, and it's the bigger venue. We moved up. If you want to get tickets to either of those, it's houseofblues.com/Houston for tickets there, mm-hmm. or kingsplace.co.uk. And then on that one, I know that you go to the calendar and just scroll to May 2nd, and you can find us listed there. But please, come on out. You guys have demanded these tickets.
Yeah.
And we put in the effort. We may have reached out, did all the contacts, signed the contracts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we are coming to you in these cities. We are working on more. So give us time. We've already gotten tweets of, hey, when are you coming to X, Y, and Z?
Right.
Trust me, we want to come to X, Y, and Z. But give us a little time. You know, we had to lay all the groundwork for these two, plus the holidays.
Yes.
Thanksgiving here in the States, followed by Christmas and New Year's. And everybody's, you know, we're taping this well in advance of when you guys see this.
Yeah.
Just because the day we record lands, one lands on Christmas and one lands on New Year's. So there we have to record well in advance because mm-hmm. no one's going to be in here. So please pick up those tickets. Once again, it's houseofblues.com/Houston for the 29th and kingsplace.co.uk for May 2nd there.
Everything that Matt just said, do it. You wanted us there? We're coming. And if there are cities that you all want to, and what Matt just said, if there are cities that want to see us do our live show, hey, make the effort yourself. Start organizing. Get people on board. Maybe start a separate. We've got a bunch of Facebook pages that we have there for separate cities that we'd started last year. So why not do one earlier this year? Why not do one for your city or suggest to us a city you want to do? And then tell us how many people you got already lined up who are jumping onto that Facebook page to set it up. Because we are more than willing to do one of these live shows every month and jump into a different city and have a little fun. Could be Wichita, could be Ghana, could be France, could be
exactly.
Australia. It doesn't matter. I've flown to Australia on a Friday, did a set visit on a Saturday, and flew back on a Sunday. So all of it is possible. I have no problem doing any of that.
Yeah, and if you have cities to suggest, you can email us at thetop10live with the number 10, thetop10live@gmail.com. Toronto, we're working on yours.
Yeah.
And then we're looking to other cities here in the States after that. Nothing is concrete, but I know there was a bunch of people that reached out from Seattle, that have reached out from New York, mm-hmm. Slash like some from Boston, Chicago. Maybe we'll come back.
Yeah.
We don't know. We're working on any dates. We're going to try and potentially squeeze something in between Houston and London. Fly in, do a Saturday, and then fly back out.
Right.
But please hit us up at thetop10live@gmail.com with the number 10, thetop10live. Let us know whatever cities, and then once we get enough of a groundswell and whatever the locale it is, we'll create a Facebook group for you guys, and you can join up over there, and we can continue the discussion there. But please join us at those two cities, those upcoming shows. You know, Chicago, we sold that out.
Yeah.
We'd like to sell out the two in Houston. People from all over Texas, get off your asses. There's a bunch of you. Some people said that they're going to, you know, fly in so far from other places in Texas because it's just too long of a drive. Texas is a big state.
Sure.
But yeah, we're flying in as well. We will see you guys over there. Mm-hmm. And I say we just jump right in.
Let's do it. Yeah. All right. You guys know, Matt, you want to tell them how the show works?
Once we set a topic, which we did for underwater movies, we go our separate ways and create individual top 10 lists. Show back up here. I do my bottom three. He does his bottom three. I do my next two. He does his next two. Then we trade one apiece. Once we have revealed our personal top 10 list, we create the shows between the two of us.
Real quick, are you excited about this movie at all, Underwater?
Have you
seen a trailer or nothing?
Nope.
Wow.
I have seen nothing.
Nothing. All right. Well, this one is Kristen Stewart's the lead. T.J. Miller's in this damn thing. It's directed by William Eubank. It says a crew of aquatic researchers work to get to safety after an earthquake devastates their subterranean laboratory, but the crew has more than the ocean seabed to fear. A little bit of the Meg vibe to it, right?
Yeah.
This idea of going deeper than normal. Vincent Cassell's in this thing as well. So it's an interesting cast. It's out in January. That doesn't usually bode well.
No, it's a dumping ground for the worst movies of the year.
Yeah, exactly. So I wonder how this thing is going to turn out, and I'm curious why Kristen Stewart, who is notoriously picky about the roles she takes, is like took this role on, because she'd been doing a lot of independent films, then that Charlie's Angels thing, which was her latest move into the mainstream public since, I think, Twilight. Really didn't do well, so is Underwater another one of these like attempts to try to kind of do something a little more distinct, or is this more of an art house film, Underwater? I don't know.
I doubt it. How many art house films are underwater?
That's what I'm saying to you.
What, the diving bell and the butterfly? That's not really underwater.
Not really underwater, though.
Has an underwater theme in the title.
Sure.
Trying to think of anything art house that would... there was that Werner Herzog one.
Ooh.
Well, it's like one? Set in space, and there's... astronauts like orbiting the Earth, but the Earth is we can't occupy it, and we don't know why.
Right.
So we have to like send a probe back or something like that. And
I've
just
never
remember
seen that one. Werner Herzog.
I know Brad Dorff's in it.
Oh,
that's literally all I know. I know the synopsis and that, and I don't know anything else.
Fair enough.
I've never seen it. I just know it exists.
Okay.
I tried to stay as much underwater as I possibly could.
Yeah.
That was my sense. We're underwater movies.
Yes.
And I also didn't want to go like, because we already did submarine movies.
We did.
So I've got some of those, but I tried to steer clear as best I could.
Right.
But it's surprising how few just straight underwater, like exploration or something, unless you're going to add in some horror element.
Yeah.
Which aren't really my jam.
There are a number of scenes, underwater scenes in movies.
Sure.
But that doesn't necessarily make it an underwater movie.
Yeah, like Pacific Rim.
Right.
They come out from the whatever, that thing in the bottom of the Marianas Trench, but
or even Jaws, you could argue.
Yeah, but
because it's on the but it's on the water. The shark is underwater, but Jaws shark. And then also there's Mission Impossible has that awesome underwater scene where Tom Cruise is trying to get that thing unlocked in time.
Oh.
The Rogue Nation, I think, is the one where he's trying to get it unlocked in time. So there's a lot of kinds of stuff, but it doesn't make it an underwater film.
Yeah, looking for something that is genuinely as much underwater as I could possibly get.
Yeah,
it,
yeah.
Which does, on some level, limit the available options.
It does.
So one of them I got a little creative.
Okay.
But it's fine. It's underwater. It's, you know, it's all, it meets all those metrics.
Okay.
But certain films, like, I just don't care about.
Gotcha.
Like, The Meg is not going to make my list.
Nope.
Or, a Deep Blue Sea.
That's not going to make my list.
Or a bunch of others where it's a lot of underwater, but I find the movie terrible.
Yeah, fair.
So it's just like, I'm sorry. Or, you know, maybe Leviathan makes your list. I haven't seen it in years. Nope. I remember thinking it was cheesy when I was a kid.
It was cheesy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a ton of those, like...
I'm happy with my list.
So am I.
Yeah,
it's a damn good list.
Yeah.
But I was trying to search for, what's only come up once or twice? What's something different? Or maybe there's a movie that we've never talked about.
Yeah.
try and get a little bit in that so we could illuminate people out there to potential other options they've never heard of.
I look forward to hearing your list.
I've got one that fits that criteria. Okay. Another one I don't think we've ever really talked about. But anyway, so I'm jumping to number 10 for me. I've got Finding Dory.
That's my number 10. Perfect, absolutely. Perfect Finding timing. Dory. Yeah, yeah.
A nice revisit to a world that everybody loved.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not as good as the first, but I still found it very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And I was curious as to how you could hang a movie on Dory's character.
Yeah.
Just because the memory lapse really, to me, was made her the perfect side character. She can float in and have fun and whatnot, but you still have, was it Merlin or Marlin? Merlin?
Marlin. Yeah, Marlin.
Marlin. Mm-hmm. You know, basically the through line.
Yep.
Keeping them on point and on story. So how do you have someone stay on story when they don't remember what the story is?
Right.
But that, the collection of new characters, like the Ed O'Neill octopus, was fantastic.
Yeah, and Jim Gaffigan is that whale, what was the bulbous whale, whatever it is?
The beluga whale?
Beluga whale, that's it. Bulbous, sorry. Yeah.
It's the white whale, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't that what he was? With that little protrusion on its head? Yeah. Yeah, and then going to the oceanography place up in the Northern California. Mm-hmm. Shoot, what is that? I think it's the one that's featured in Star Trek IV.
Oh, okay. The Whale Institute that's up there?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, it's not – technically, I think they call it a Whale Institute, but it's like the just a major initial hub on the West Coast for marine or aquatic research.
Okay.
It's something Bay.
Michael Bay?
No. The actual name of – yep, it's Six Underground. That's the name of it.
Did you see this one yet?
No.
Okay.
No. Every review I've
it's
read –
been bad.
Oh, it's been beyond bad.
Yeah.
Where it's like he's created a new style of stupid. Like, that's not good. Although I've seen a couple of people say online, it's pretty good. You know, I enjoyed it. But so be it. If
JT.
Did he?
Yeah, he did.
I'm not surprised.
I don't see it. Is he Aquarium of the Bay, Lucky Ocean Aquarium, Sixth Avenue Aquarium, Maritime Museum?
No.
Aquatic Park Grove Aquatic Park? No, maybe Research? Maybe I should type in Research and see what comes up. Marine Science Institute, maybe.
Monterey Bay.
Oh, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research
Institute.
That's
south. Okay. South of San Jose.
Fair enough.
I think that's where they end up is Monterey Bay.
Monterey Bay. Oh, no. Wait, that's Botany Bay. I'm a bad.
But yeah, just an overall very quality film.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's very funny. It's not as good as the first one.
No.
But doesn't mean it's not a damn good movie and very enjoyable time, especially if you have kids. Certainly a fun movie for that. But also, look, you took a character a lot of people love from the first one, Dory, right? And you make her the central part. Marlin is best as a facilitator to the protagonist,
straight
right?
Straight man.
Yeah, straight man. Exactly. Ironically, being Albert Brooks. But this is so good at showing you some emotion and emotional journey, rather, the character goes on trying to get back home, right? They helped Marlin reunite with Nemo in the first film, and then they get back home. How do we get Dory back home? How do you get somebody home who's got short-term memory loss? It must be incredibly difficult, right? And so there's even shades of whatever – what are those illnesses that people go through? People have like –
Amnesia?
Yeah, amnesia. Like that kind of stuff or whatever. People go through that. So how do you get them to come back? What are the sensors and things of that nature? Mm-hmm. So when she gets reunited at the end, you're just like, oh, my God. It's heartbreaking.
Well,
right?
The little – like the – was it shells?
Yes.
That lead her back?
Yeah.
The parents did as kids, and they're continuing on under the belief that she's still there. She's
still
out
there
somewhere.
Someday she will come back.
Yeah, you know, we've seen numerous times within movies the undying belief that they're not gone. Like,
right.
You still feel them kind of you know, jazz, and ultimately it pays off. I love that who plays the dad because he's got a receding hairline for the fish. All the fish have the same kind of coloration, and he's got a receding hairline.
Good question.
It's not Richard Kind.
It's not?
I don't think so.
It's not Odenkirk?
No, it's not Odenkirk.
Okay.
I think it might be somebody who was actually bald in real life.
Oh, boy. How dare you. Ed O'Neill, Ty Burrell? No?
No, Ty Burrell plays.
Eugene Levy? Is it Eugene Levy?
Yeah, I think it is Eugene Levy.
Yep.
He is not bald. He's got a thick, thick head of hair.
And Diane Keaton. They're both.
Yeah, but he's got like a – I think he has a receding hairline throughout the movie. Like it starts at one and then by the end – as far as that type of fish is concerned.
Oh, fascinating. I forgot Sigourney Weaver's in this as the voice in the Yeah. All right. A lot of people. Idris Elba's in this damn thing. Dominic West as well. Oh. Little Wire reunion. Is that right, Dominic West? Isn't he in The Wire?
Yes, he is.
McNulty? McNulty. Yeah. Yeah, there you go. All right, that's your number 10.
So 9, I've got a movie we've never talked about.
Ooh.
Sphere.
Oh, you like that one. All right, knock yourself out.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I put it on there because we've never talked about it.
That's fair.
Otherwise, it was just like, well, I'm going to slot in another submarine movie here. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to limit the number of submarine movies.
Okay.
We do just because, or at least I do.
I'm sorry.
It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. Sphere's a psychological kind of horror-ish thriller type of thing where so they discover what they assume is an alien ship at the bottom of the ocean. It's under like hundreds of years of silt or whatever else that has been deposited upon it.
Yeah.
And then it turns out this is actually an American-made ship. They assumed it was alien. And then they figure out that this thing actually traveled back in time to get here. And then they figure out like it just keeps – the wormhole keeps going deeper and deeper and deeper, or the rabbit hole rather. And then, you know, it's got a great cast with Dustin Hoffman and Sam Jackson, Sharon Stone.
Yep.
Oh, who is the – there's a fourth. Is Liev Schreiber in this?
It sounds like he would be in this.
Yeah. And then there, I think – is Peter Coyote in this?
Ooh, good pull, Peter Coyote.
I think he might be in
Sharon
this.
Stone, Peter Coyote is in this. Liev Schreiber's in this. Queen Latifah's in this.
Okay.
Huey Lewis is in this.
Of course.
He's the helicopter pilot. But yeah, that's pretty much the stand. That's pretty much the
of the known names.
Yeah, the known names. And Barry Levinson directed this one.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of crazy.
It's a Michael Crichton book.
That's this is my entry point in the sphere. When I read the reviews, I didn't go see it because Michael Crichton, that book is a seminal book in my life. Like I was in the military at the time, and I was just like desperate to get into an author for whatever reason, needed something to read. Mm-hmm. And Crichton, I started. I didn't want to do Jurassic Park because I wasn't always the biggest fan of that movie. But I was like, well, what else is here?
The book is so good.
Yeah, right. And I probably should read it now in retrospect. But yeah. I went through a run of Crichton. But Sphere, I read 3 times in 1 summer.
Okay.
It's just an incredible book. And when the reviews weren't positive, I didn't go see the movie because I didn't want anything to taint my enjoyment of that fucking book. The book was so goddamn good, and I loved the exploration they did, the emotional shit, the twists and turns going on with these characters. And of course, it's supposed to be – I think Hoffman and Sharon Stone are supposed to like be a couple in the book. So the fact that I didn't really buy them as a couple in the movie, so I wasn't going to go see it. So, but overall, I did not see Sphere, but I'll say this. The book is incredible. And so I'm kind of mad that they didn't get it right because this could have been just as good as Jurassic Park.
But that's a lot of Crichton books that get turned into movies.
True. Andromeda Strain is another one no one talks about. That's
well,
a Crichton
the
book.
13th Warrior, which
yeah, oh my
Eaters
God.
Of the Dead,
yeah, yeah.
Which I actually don't mind that movie.
Okay.
But the book is obviously, it's way better.
That could be something. Crichton books turned into top 10 Crichton books as movies.
Yeah, on an off week, sure.
Yeah.
January is the type of month for those things. Although, let's see, what else we got? Obviously, Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Timeline, the movie sucks.
Oh, God, that sucks.
But the book is pretty good. Book is super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, like, you know, breaking someone down to ones and zeros and then faxing them, I think, is the way they relate it, just to make it understandable to people at the time.
Right.
Back in time to a specific moment and whatnot. It's... That one was super interesting, but the movie fails.
Right. Westworld is a Crichton book.
It is.
That was turned into a movie. And he wrote and directed the film. Wow.
Yeah, the first one?
Wow. Yeah, the original.
I knew he wrote it. I didn't know he directed it.
Yeah. Crichton wrote and directed the science fiction thriller Westworld.
Wow.
Wow. He also did he wrote Terminal Man.
Okay.
Yeah. Coma. I remember Coma.
Never read that one.
Runaway, the one with Tom Selleck.
Mm-hmm.
Jurassic Park, Disclosure. I didn't know he wrote that one.
Okay.
I forgot he wrote that one. Congo. Congo's a great book.
Movie is not.
The movie is terrible.
Yeah, the movie is not.
Crichton co-wrote the screenplay for Twister. Yeah, Sphere. It's a 1987 novel. Jesus, right. Yeah, about the story of a psychologist who was called by the U.S. Navy to join a team of scientists to examine an enormous spacecraft. Right. 13th Warrior, Timeline, The Andromeda Strain. Those are the ones. Those are the ones.
And he's had others... Prey was a good book.
Right.
That was – I could see that being made into a movie now, especially with people's understanding of technology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean Crichton books themselves?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are a lot of great
Crichton Prey was about the nanobots?
Yes.
I think so. I don't know. It's been years since I read that one. But
yeah.
I definitely see people being able to understand that better now visually.
Yeah.
Shit, that's the new Vin Diesel movie – next year.
Oh, Rising Sun's another one. That's a Crichton.
Oh, that is
book.
A Crichton. Mm-hmm. It's a good movie.
That is a good movie. Yeah. I remember reading Rising Sun. Rising Sun was damn good. Something called The Great Train Robbery is Crichton as well, which mm-hmm. I never read.
Yeah, I never read that one.
Interesting. All right. All right. And, of course, The Lost World and all the Jurassic ones, of course.
So spheres, you know, basically they find this sphere and then all the shit that comes out of interacting with this sphere, this unknown technology and how it affects all the central characters within the film itself.
Yeah.
Sharon Stone, Dustin Hoffman, and Sam Jackson. You know, it's interesting. It's unique.
Yeah.
And it's number 9, you know?
All right. Which is number 8?
8 is Atlantis, The Lost Empire.
Oh, man. I was so close to putting that on, dude. I was so close to putting that on, and I was like to myself, well, do I really, really love it as much as, like, Treasure Planet? I'm like, I don't know, but there's so much to enjoy here.
There is.
So
a lot of visual. Plus,
you might talk me into it. Am I, it's a fluid list always. You might talk me into it. I might put it on here. Please, go ahead. This is Michael J. Fox, right?
Yeah, he's the lead. Yeah. Milos or Milos, and I can't remember the character's last name.
Yeah.
And then for the life of me. So I think James Garner plays the heavy.
Okay.
Do you know that old SNL character, the Italian priest or whatever?
Yeah, Don Novello.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone, if it's not him, someone is doing a version of that character, and he plays the explosives expert.
Okay.
And then beyond that, I don't know that I can pull any names as to who. Oh, Leonard Nimoy is the head of the Atlanteans.
Okay.
I can't pull any others.
Yeah, Don Novello is in
there you go.
Is in it. David Ogden Steers is in it.
No.
Oh, he's the voice of Cogsworth in Beauty and the Beast.
That's good.
Oh, you've never seen him? Like MASH, the TV show. You ever see the TV show?
What character is he playing?
He's Winchester, the British dude. Yeah, okay. Let's see. Claudia Christian's in this. I remember her in that film, Hexed. John Mahoney from Frasier.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Okay.
He's in this. Cree Summer. Jim Varney does a voice.
Sure.
In this as well. So, yeah. Right.
So, Milos or Milos?
Yeah, Milo Thatch.
Or Milo. There
yeah.
You go. Basically has a crazy idea that he thinks he knows the secret of Atlantis, something that's been rumored, this previous, you know, civilization that got subsumed at some point by the ocean. And within this, they mm-hmm. basically, it's almost like they've been buried underneath, like they're protected underneath the ocean, kind of buried within the earth itself, like a subterranean kind of civilization. And he thinks he knows the route then. It's kind of like Stargate.
Yeah.
Where James Spader has figured out what actually all these hieroglyphs and whatnot mean.
Yeah.
Milo plays the same type of individual where everybody looks at him as a kook.
Yeah.
But it ends up he's, you know, technically correct.
Yeah.
And to see a tale that everybody's heard variations of, or at least knows the lore of Atlantis. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Homer was the first one to write about Atlantis.
Is it real?
Atlantis?
Did it exist?
I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows.
Yeah, right? There's never been an excavation of it, or found anything?
No, we would know
okay.
if they found Atlantis.
Okay. It took them forever to find Titanic, the ship.
Yeah.
It took them a while.
But that's also because it's below 2 miles of water.
Well, that's what I'm saying. How deep would Atlantis be? Do you think it's just super buried?
If it existed?
Listen, you're the science guy on this show. Tell me.
If it existed, so more than likely like it was some sort of tectonic shift.
Right.
That happened.
Earthquake, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And it fell into the ocean.
Right.
So if it does, if there is any remnants of it,
okay.
They would be, it'd have to be rubble.
Okay. So it wouldn't exist.
I don't know. I don't know.
I just want to know because I remember watching that old show In Search Of. And Atlantis and the Bermuda Triangle were always the top two subjects they talked about.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. Because it's just you can say whatever you want. You can speculate as much as you like.
Yeah.
And there's no way to disprove any of it because it's all just, you know, conspiratorial or you can run wild with it because who's going to contradict you? You can say Atlanteans had, you know, two sets of hands. You know? Who's going to say no? Yeah. Who's going to say no? Like, oh, that's not correct. How do you know?
Right.
Like, that's where the ancient alien stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you can run wild with that speculation. Go crazy. The fact that, like,
pyramids or something.
Yeah. Well, the pyramids, that one doesn't, you know, I've never really watched any of it. I've just had it distilled from a dipshit friend of mine. And he's not really a friend, he's a friend of a friend. and he was trying to tell me about how the Egyptians had electricity and all these other things. And I'm like, okay, there is no evidence to support that I've ever seen. And I'm not an Egyptologist.
You don't understand, man.
Yeah. They had all this. There's no way, man. The technology would be like, they built a pyramid. It's not like it was, you know, it's a hell of an engineering marvel.
Of course.
Just like Machu Picchu. You build that thing up on the top of a mountaintop and whatnot, and the cut lines of the stone are so precise that you can't slip a piece of paper through it. They still fit beautifully to this day. Like, well, I guess, you know, when you're a king and you have all the time in the world, or a ruler, whatever the case is, and then I don't know, but I don't believe that aliens came down and helped them build big stone.
All right.
Monoliths. It doesn't make sense to me, but what do I know? I'm not an alien.
Well, Wikipedia says it's a fictional island mentioned with an allegory on the hubris of nations in Plato's work.
Timaeus. I thought it was Homer. Okay.
Well, where it represents the antagonist naval power that besieged ancient Athens. The pseudo-historic embodiment of Plato's ideal state in the Republic. In the story, Athens repels the Atlantean attack unlike any other nation of the known world, supposedly giving testament to the superiority of Plato's concept of a state. The story concludes with Atlantis falling out of favor with deities and submerging into the Atlantic Ocean. So it's always been a stuff of legend, I guess, but no one's ever really proved that it existed is what you're trying to say.
But they attacked the Grecians?
Yeah.
From the Atlantic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it'd be off, the coast of Africa or something?
Sure, if you say so. I don't get involved in geography.
Still on the Atlantic Ocean.
It's not really
if you
thing.
Went on the eastern side of Africa. I'm just trying to think if it was on the eastern side of Europe, it was on Spain or France or something like that, there would, I don't know.
Mediterranean, right?
Well, the Mediterranean isn't part of the Atlantic.
Right.
So if they're Atlanteans, they'd have to be on the Atlantic Ocean.
Good point. Okay.
But you'd need easy ingress into the Mediterranean. So you'd be over off the coast of Morocco or Canary Islands or Spain.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Okay.
If you're going to take on Greece.
During the early first century, the Hellenistic Jewish philosopher Philo wrote about the destruction of Atlantis in his On the Eternity of the World. Hmm. And in a longer passage, allegedly cited by Aristotle's successor, Theophrastus. There was a successor to Aristotle? How does that work?
Well, they were all kind of one beget the other. They were all students of Plato and Socrates were students of Aristotle, I believe.
Okay. Who killed himself, Socrates? Or did they all do it?
Let's see. Whoever Plato's teacher was, I think it was Aristotle, he was killed.
Okay, he was killed. Okay.
Fascinating. Yeah, I'm not sure.
All these guys. All right, cool. Good stuff, though. I mean, that's a fantastic film that a lot of people talk about, and I wanted to put it on my list, but at the end of the day, I was like, well, do I really come back to this one as much? Or I think this one's as high as other ones, so I couldn't do it. But that's your number 8.
That's my 8. What do you got? 10 we did.
10's I'm doing it. 9 is Crimson Tide.
Oh, that's a slight pun.
Fine, fair. 8 is Black Sea.
That's a pun.
Okay, cool. What's your 7?
That's interesting. So what do you have at the top part? Okay. Well, now I'm looking at my side list.
Don't you want to know?
I only have like two or three that didn't make my list, and I don't see any of those being higher than both of those movies. 7 is Crimson Tide.
Don't you want to know? All right, yeah, go ahead.
We will eventually get to it.
Yeah, I might be cheating on one, but go ahead, yeah.
A nice taut thriller, hell of a cast.
Yes.
Denzel Washington, Gene Hackman, James Gandolfini, early Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah.
You see Gandolfini's son is doing a prequel to Sopranos?
Yeah. The
Michael Gandolfini?
Wait, yeah. Is he doing the David Chase movie?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That I saw already.
Something of Newark.
Yeah.
The Angels Prince of Newark. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I just read an article about it where he said he never watched the film until Chase contacted him about potentially – or not the film, the show.
Yeah.
Until Chase contacted him about potentially doing this, and he sat down and watched it from episode 1 through the finale.
What?
Yeah.
He'd never seen the show before? Or he was rewatching?
His dad died when he was 13 or 14.
Still. Oh, well, I guess you're right. That you wouldn't be watching that
show. Yeah, you wouldn't be watching it at 10, 11, 12.
No responsible parent is letting their child watch that show at that age. Yeah, good point.
And he said, like, he asked his dad, he went on set one time, he's like, what's it about? And he's like, hey, it's a mobster that goes to a psychiatrist.
It's about construction.
Exactly. About waste management.
Yeah, waste management. What's the big deal?
I'm intrigued because I like him on The Deuce, and I see him as his father, but at the same time, like, Gandolfini is a standard. Like, he is.
Yeah.
I don't know how you replicate that. Even if you are his son,
yeah.
You may look like him, but
right.
He carried a certain weight, even, like, no pun intended. Just, he had a gravity when he walked into every scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I believed him in that role more so than anybody else, and I'm not taking away from what everybody else did.
Yeah.
He just firmly seemed, that's a Don. That guy definitely runs something.
Yep.
The only one I never really bought was Pantoliano.
Joey Pants?
Yeah.
When he was on guest starring on the show?
Yeah. I never bought him as someone that is going to go head-to-head with Tony.
It was weird because they put him through a bunch of shit, you know, with that thing with...
Janice.
Yeah, with Janice and him getting, like having sex with a dildo. And all of that was so weird. They made him as depraved as possible. And it was just weird.
It was weird.
You know, the Buscemi thing, I think, worked better.
Okay.
Yeah. I liked him better on the show than I liked Joey Pants.
Okay.
My favorite death is still Janice killing that dude. Killing her, Richie Aprile's dad. Whoever the fuck that guy is.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I love that kid.
Oh, big puss.
Came out of nowhere. Well, puss is more of a poetic death, right? This death is out of nowhere. You don't expect Janice
I know, but when
to
there's
do that.
Sitting on the boat.
It's great.
And he's lying to him about the masseuse.
And they're just staring at him.
Yeah.
And they fucking know the whole fucking time.
Exactly.
And puss does too. Puss is just playing this whole thing out.
They're laughing, but you can just see how hollow Gandolfini's eyes
are.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah. And eventually he's like, did that really happen? And you're like, oh. Tony, not in the face, huh? Not in the face. What do you think we're on a boat for, Puss?
Yeah.
What do you think? You're not.
Yeah.
No, you're not.
Well, the thing is, he says not in the face, right? He says, of course not, of course not. And then, boom, shoots him in the face. And I don't even know if he shoots him in the face first. I think he shoots him in the face at the end just to kind of fucking – you're not even going to get this. I'm not even going to give you this much respect. Like, you're just – it's over. And I know they spend – don't they spend the rest of the season, like, trying to deny – they say he just disappeared or he ran off or whatever?
I think there's only, like, one more episode.
Oh, is there that season? Okay, okay.
Yeah. They build to that because the one before is where he has that fever dream because he got food poisoning.
Yeah, right.
The fish is talking to him.
I know, right?
What
was the other one?
It was brutal.
What was the gay? Who was the gay guy again? The one that they found out he was gay.
Oh,
he was good. His death was good too.
Yeah, where he's blowing that dude in a truck.
Oh yeah, man.
And they catch him.
Oh, dude. That was a rough. Wasn't it Vinny?
You could make up any.
Tony,
Jimmy.
Yeah, Vito Spadafore. Vito.
There you go.
Yeah, it was Vito. Yeah, dude. And he was married to Maria. That's right. They had two kids. Closeted homosexual, right? Yeah, damn, dude. And when they finally got him, because you didn't know, like, was he going to get away? Were they going to be okay with a gay dude in the
Cardinal
crew?
Sin.
Yeah, right. And he's bringing in money. He's earning.
It's, you know, have you updated your understanding of human, you know, psychology and whatnot to just be tolerant of the fact that the world has all different kinds?
Yeah.
So, of course, you have a large enough population of individuals within your group.
Of course.
There's bound to be, you know,
right.
percentage-wise of this or whatever the case is.
Right.
Yeah, that was pretty brutal. But so Crimson Tide is,
okay.
in essence, you know, it's a movie about – it's a nuclear submarine, mm-hmm. and they are underneath the ocean, and they get a partial message of what action needs to happen. And Hackman – is on one side and Denzel's on the other. Now, Denzel's the, I don't want to say disgraced XO, but he's not held in high favor with everybody else because of the reverence that everyone has for Gene Hackman.
Right.
And Denzel's kind of like, he should have gotten his own boat by now, but he's forced to be XO kind of one last time, which actually happens a decent amount. You know, it's like on U571.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew McConaughey is supposed to get his own boat, but Paxton is like, you're not ready yet because you're not willing to sacrifice. You know, whatever it takes to get the mission accomplished.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually he learns that, you know, lesson ultimately. Yeah. And that did not make my list.
All right.
So, basically the message that gets broken up is Hackman believes we need to launch a nuclear strike.
Yes.
And Denzel is saying the message is incomplete and you have no basis to do that.
Right.
And it's a back and forth. Like, you can see the logic of both sides of Hackman of, like, if we delay, they could have already launched and we could already be at war.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of could have.
They're both aggressive in their own ways, mm-hmm. right? With Denzel, it's about this idea of, like, he's taking a big chance to be this aggressive. Because I think Hackman brings him onto the boat, I think, or he gets assigned to the boat, if I remember correctly. And they have to learn to deal with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, Hackman comes out with the dog, the walking the dog. And there's this intimidation factor, right?
Yeah, he gets to flaunt rules.
Exactly. And this, but it's a microcosm. The film works for me because it's a microcosm. It's a microcosm of a country. Of a government, right? On the ship, essentially, there is a president, which is the captain. There is a second in command, which is essentially a vice president or a secretary of defense, whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. And then, what's the secretary that goes around the world? I forget, what the fuck, my brain.
Secretary of State?
Secretary of State. There's a secretary of state, right? And then, of course, everybody else, essentially, are like senators or representatives, whatever you want to
sure.
say. But either way, and then there's the citizens. Either way, you have a system you have to run through, right? So the president, Hackman, is saying this message has been received and I think I need to act. We're being attacked. I need to defend my country with a nuclear code and I'm going to put it in motion. Mm-hmm. But the vice president or secretary of state, whichever one Denzel is taking a chance to go against the president. And then the other people have to either adhere to the rules or break the rules to follow what they need to follow. So
yeah.
What is your actual commitment to the principles you signed on for here in the military, on this boat, being essentially a mini government on the boat? And it's like, because I love the Zunza moment where he's like, I don't want to follow you. I'm not your friend. I'm doing this because it's the law, the way I'm supposed to do it. But I don't want to follow you. So I love that it's a very complicated situation between both Hackman and Washington. And by the end, you don't 100% know that Washington was right to do what he did. Yes, in the end, there was not a nuclear attack. But had there been one, Washington would have been completely wrong all the way around.
True. But he, in accordance with the military code or understanding mm-hmm. of what the rules of engagement are,
yeah.
Denzel was in the right. And I think my favorite part of the movie is they go to the court tribunal, whatever the case is,
mm-hmm.
and Hackman is basically given a slap on the wrist and allowed to go into early retirement, thereby indemnifying the military from any kind of without having to basically say we're culpable or anybody's culpable. Be like, why don't we just sweep this under the rug?
Yeah.
You go about. We'll give you your retirement because you're in essence like a higher up. You get your golden parachute and you get to get out.
Yeah, Nixon, you can resign.
Mm-hmm.
Or be impeached.
Exactly.
And he resigned.
If you resign, we'll give you the pardon.
Yeah, we'll give you the pardon and we'll all move
just
on.
Walk away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah, that was when I saw that. I was like, that's honest.
Right.
That is very honest because there was no – it's not like he launched the strike. Had he launched the strike, there's no way you could say, hey, you were kind of right. Be like, no, we would have to – you would be going to jail if not dying.
Yeah, also he didn't pull a Colonel Kurtz where he ran off like renegade to do this, right?
Yeah.
It was he heard a message – a part of a message. He thought this is what he needs to do according to his code of conduct, right? He was following the rules as he has been trained to follow the rules. So that's why you give him the slap on the wrist, because you understand why he was doing what he was doing. He wasn't going rogue. So, yeah. All right. What's your number seven?
That was my seven.
Oh, sorry. What's your number six?
My six is the Poseidon Adventure.
That's a punt.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's a punt, guy. Calm it down.
Oh, okay, Mr. I.
Calm it down.
Crimson Tide at 11. And Black Sea at fucking 9 or whatever the case was.
Black Sea's at 8.
Oh, much better.
7 is Das Boot.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Is it because we've talked about it?
Yes.
Okay.
Ad nauseum.
That's fine.
Ad nauseum.
That's fine. But that is a slap in the face to one of the best war movies ever made.
Yeah, well, they're German. They'll get over it. They'll get over it.
Okay.
They're Nazis. They'll get over it.
Their nationality, I think, is irrelevant to what is portrayed on film. Because it's not like they're firing torpedoes and saying anti-Semitic things. As they're, it's not like hitting the button and being like, yes. Exactly. It's they're just guys doing a job.
Oh, all right.
Well, I don't know how.
The way it's presented, you're right.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know how much of the population was complicit or understanding fully of the actions that the government that they elected were taking. I don't know.
Yeah.
If it was fully like everybody was on board, yes. But if you watch, like, say, Band of Brothers, when they discover the camps whatnot, and then the local populace all to a person said, we had no idea.
Yeah, that's what they claim.
They claim.
Yeah.
Now, I would assume, I don't know, but I would assume there is a certain percentage of that population that did not know.
Right. Sure.
But, like, the woman.
But you knew what this guy was representing. And you knew what this – and all the speeches.
Yeah.
You knew where the fuck this asshole was going.
But you don't know that just because he doesn't – or despises and is bigoted towards Jewish people, that also means that he's going to try and eradicate them
right
as best he can. Like, perhaps – I don't know how much of that message got to the rank and file.
I think when you study history, and this is the convenient shield people use sometimes – if you study history, as soon as a leader starts talking initially about a certain minority populace or a certain religious group, a certain diverse group, and starts to connotate, put into negative connotation on that group in order to turn the public against that group, ethnic cleansing is really not that far of a step afterwards.
It depends on how much power they have.
The second you dehumanize a section of people, then killing them becomes not...
Yeah, it's not
actual
as heinous.
Killing.
Yeah.
Right.
They're
to
not
them,
people anymore.
Yeah. To them, it's eradicating an enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, I just don't know how much of that information was distilled down to the average citizen or rank and file soldier.
Yeah. All right.
I don't know. Okay. So it could have been like a pamphlet that everybody got. Hey, you get your paychecks on Fridays, pick
also,
up your rations.
This.
And also, we're going to try and kill as many Jewish people as we can get our
as
hands
we can.
On. You're like, oh,
so
Jesus.
Get ready. Yikes.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to be a part of this anymore.
Whoa, guy.
So what's your next one?
All right. So my next one is number 7. That's boot, right? Number 6, The Hunt for Red October.
I didn't put it on.
Wow.
Because they spend a decent amount of the movie outside of the water.
Oh, because it's in the sub? But they're in the sub.
No. Well, they're in the sub, but like.
Oh, when they surface?
There's the preamble to him even getting on the sub.
Right, sure. Oh, yeah, sure.
So it's all the build up too. And eventually, the second half of the film, yes, they're underwater. So, like, technically, to me, Atlantis, they're still under the water, even if they're going through the earth and whatnot.
All right, fine.
They're under the water. Whereas for me, for Red October is like, well, yeah, but there's the build up of he's got to convince.
Yeah.
The intelligence community that he's potentially right.
Yeah.
And then he's got to fly out to the carrier, and the carrier's got to get him on a helicopter, and the helicopter's got to get him to the USS Indianapolis, I believe it is. And then Indianapolis, from that point, they're underwater. But then they flash back to, like, James Earl Jones, who's outside of.
Right.
And they're still dealing with. So I was like, okay. I want more undersea.
Okay. I'm not going to fault you for that, if you want to go that route.
Look, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was surprised. You give me shit putting Das Boot so low, and here you're not even putting Hunt for October on the fucking.
Well, because Das Boot is about 90% underwater.
Oh, I see.
And percentage-wise, I don't know what Hunt for Red October is.
It's probably
although it's been a long time since I've seen Sphere 2. So I don't remember how much of Sphere. I know a lot of it happens underwater.
Good.
So
I'm seeing a very strong list from Matt Nost here.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been a while. Sphere's not one I'm going to go back and rewatch anytime soon.
All right.
But we've never talked about it, so I was like, I'll throw this on. I've already got enough sub-movies.
Yeah. Okay.
So we don't really need to get into another, effing sub-movie.
Yeah, fair.
And for me, that one was like, percentage-wise, it seems like Jack Ryan spends a good chunk of the first part of the film out of the water.
Yeah. He does. All right, fine. If you want to invalidate this selection, that's fine.
No, it's great. I think it's great. We should make a list.
No.
Should make as many lists as it possibly can.
I don't want it on your list if you don't want it on your list.
Well, it's not on my list.
Well, I don't want it on my list if you don't want it on my list.
Well, we're going to have a lot of commonality, and then it's going to be a fight to the death of who makes the last, like, two spots, I'm assuming, thus far. But we've already had a couple punts, and my guess is we're about to get into a few more that we've got in common.
Yeah,
well.
Probably. All right. Well, let's take a look here. Where I'm at then. So that was my six, but maybe, okay, you know what? Here, I'll take it off. Okay, I think you make a good point.
I wish there was an easy way to search that. Like,
So I'll just
in
put,
the subs.
I'll put Atlantis Lost Empire number 10 then.
Okay.
Well, so that helps me out. Okay. So that was number 6, Das Boot, and it's a punt, right? So
yeah, that's still a punt.
Okay. You're
still
5. A punt.
Well, before we get to my number 5, why don't we take a quick break and hear this word from our sponsor? There we go.
Wow. Those are two dulcet tones breaking down some stuff.
Please, yeah, and make sure that you support our sponsors because yeah. when you go to them and whatnot, then they continue running ads on our show, and it helps us stay afloat in essence and you know, come out to the cities like we talked about before with Houston and London. You know, we that takes – before we even get there, we have to, you know, lay out a little financial groundwork to make all that stuff happen.
People are already buying tickets.
Oh, yeah, before
– as we're recording this.
When we did the initial announcement on King's Place, because they said we may have the link up, and that's as far as we knew.
Yeah.
That we were given the email from them saying we may have the link up by X, but we'll let you know for sure. And then we got tweets saying, hey, I already got my ticket.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's awesome. They didn't email us back letting us know that they were going to open up to the public. It was great. Let's get those sales going. Kingsplace.co.uk and houseofblues.com/Houston for the February 29th in Houston. And once again, May 2nd in London. but please come on. And our thanks to those sponsors. And let's move on.
So yeah, let's do it.
Five for me is the punt previously, which is Black Sea.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about it.
It's a fantastic submarine movie.
Yeah.
It's Jude Law.
Yes.
And let's see, Ben Mendelsohn.
Mm-hmm.
Guy with a ridiculous name who's a good actor.
Tobias Menzies?
No. Is Tobias Menzies? Oh, yeah, he's the rich guy.
He's the rich guy.
That's paying for all of it.
Yep.
No. Shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Let me look it up.
Tell me more.
He's got a ridiculous name.
Tobias Menzies was not it.
No.
That's not a ridiculous enough of a name.
Scoot McNairy.
Oh, Scoot. Yeah, Scoot's great in this film.
It's a ridiculous name. I'm sorry, Scoot. You're a hell of an actor.
No offense, Scoot.
No, please. Please take no offense.
You're good in BVS.
And it's a great actor's name because there is no other Scoot.
Right.
But
I forgot that Jodie Whittaker's in this as well. All right. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So Black Sea is a movie where Jude Law is a what is he, an excavation kind of...
So he makes his money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Working underneath, you know, the ocean, which actually, that stuff pays buku bucks.
I'm sure it does.
Like underwater welding, there was, you know, I heard how much they make, and for like a good solid hour, like 15 years ago, I thought about doing it. I was like, oh, dude, they make crazy good money.
Yeah?
Because it's...
What's the life expectancy on the guy?
Oh, I don't know. I can't imagine it's terrible.
Okay.
But you need to live, you know, basically anywhere that there's oil rigs and whatnot.
I got to look this up. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's kind of like longshoremen. Like down in Long Beach, I know I know some people that, you know, that their kids and whatnot got into because they're thinking about getting into they're in high school. But it's a six-figure job from the jump.
Okay.
And it only goes up.
Wow.
Underwater welders. A six-figure job from the jump.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as you accrue more experience and whatnot, it can go up and up and up.
Yeah.
Because it's such a highly specified field.
Yeah.
Because you need to have the certification for welding. You need to have the certification for diving. You need to have the certification for, you know, just all these various technical aspects.
Yeah.
So anyway, he is in that world, and he's been laid off.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs a job. And he's kind of figuring out what he's going to do. I believe he's on the dole.
Yeah.
And not really... You know, enjoying himself newly. He's lost his family because the sea kind of keeps calling him.
Yeah.
And he always goes back out to work. So he doesn't really – he's long since divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe he's got at least one – I want to say it's a daughter. But anyway.
Yeah.
So he gets approached by Menzies – by Scoot McNairy or somebody for Menzies saying, we found something.
Yeah.
And it's in international waters.
It's gold.
It's Nazi gold. But because it's landed in international waters, whoever gets it owns it.
Yep.
Which is a fascinating little maritime law. Still exists to this day. You can if you can go find any wreck, so long as it's in international waters, you could keep the bounty of whatever you find.
Wow.
Yeah. And there are numerous wrecks throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
That's another one I've read and we're like, wow, what an interesting job because it takes a ton of money to get into it. But the potential payoff is so massive, and there are certain guys that they're always chasing. They're always out there looking for. Yeah. And they have these huge You ever seen like the machines they do for panning for gold and whatnot? They go in and it goes through like all these little layers. They have that kind of version where you go down with these big vacuum suctions and you're sucking up.
Yeah.
And you can find, oh, okay, we're on the right kind of track. And they have these huge excavation arms. But anyway, so they're down there to find Nazi gold. So they have to get this ragtag group of other desperate individuals just like Jude Law.
Yeah.
And basically –
Russians.
Yeah, they get some Russians. Yep. And then they have the – you know, the Anglican or English side.
Yeah.
And there's the fight between the two. And basically, it's all Mendelsohn. Mendelsohn playing the pitch-perfect prick once again.
Yeah. Always good at it.
He is. He is always good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens from there, I don't want to ruin it, but it's just this tension that is created. And there's also the drive within all of them of the payday from this is so crazy. And I believe it's like it's sitting on a silt bank and it's about to just dip over this huge trench.
Yeah.
So if they get it now, it's theirs. Otherwise, it's going to fall to the depths of the ocean and no one will ever get it.
Yeah.
Or they'll get beaten to the punch by another, you know, operating or another concern that's coming in that's trying to get it as well.
Yeah.
And the tension between all the different motivating factors for all the characters is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I know why it didn't do well in the theater because
– it's a small film.
It is.
It's an independent film. Talk about independent underwater film. Essentially an independent underwater
film. Kind of.
Yeah.
But it's got a cast where it doesn't seem like an independent underwater film.
Right. But Jude Law is not really known for headlining a lot of casts anymore.
True.
Back in the 90s, early 2000s, yes, but not by the time Black Sea came out. But you've got great, you've got good actors that populate this thing, good character actors like Scoot McNairy and certainly Ben Mendelsohn. As far as underwater welding, here goes, underwater welding needs to deal with hearing problems. The muscle ache can be another sign of risk. Memory and cognitive ability functions getting
loose from the cold water.
Right. The threat of electric shocks.
Yep.
Even drowning, which can be caused by the failure of equipment, hypothermia and decompression sickness.
Sure. You can get the bends. Sure.
Yeah,
yeah. But what do they make?
It says six figures starting out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To start.
And then you have overtime and something called diffusion, which I don't know what that is.
Yeah. I don't know what that is either.
Yeah.
But it's a,
Yeah. And the life expectancy is about 35 to 40 years old. That's the average age of an underwater welder is between 35 to 40. So that's the average age. Of those doing it. Not when they die.
Yeah. I thought you were saying their life expectancy is 35 to 40. It's like, wow, that's worse than like crab fishermen. And,
why even bother?
Yeah, and loggers. That's like, that's crazy dangerous.
Yeah, you get a lot of certifications. You need a lot of certifications.
Yeah, you do. It's one after another
mm-hmm.
Down the line.
What I enjoy about it is that film is that it twists and turns all the time. You are on board with the protagonists, but then you know that eventually the Mendelsohn thing is going to kick in. And cause some kind of issue. The problem is that throughout the last half of that movie, there's just constant state of like trying to figure out what the right thing to do is in this moment and constant decisions that are being made that lead to what happens at the end of the movie. And you're just like, oh, man, this – you couldn't have even said this one final decision caused whatever it caused. You have to go back multiple decisions.
Yeah, it's a cascading effect.
Right. It's a chain effect. And it's like, oh, man, this is brilliant in that way. And I appreciated the movie for that. All right, that was your number five?
That was my five.
So my five is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Okay.
Classic film. Kirk Douglas, James Mason. And this is one of those Disney films that nobody really talks about. It is essentially a sci-fi film, but it's underwater. And, of course, has all this stuff to do with Captain Nemo and the legend of Captain Nemo and all that. But it's a fantastically fun Disney film. Kirk Douglas is great in this thing as well. So overall, I just think it's one of those films I go back to all the time. Whenever it – like the fact that it's on Disney Plus now makes me super happy because I can just pop it on whenever I want. It's something I grew up with as a kid all the time. And it's what I go back to whenever I want to revisit seeing those old Disney movies growing up as a kid that they would play every once in a while. Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah. No, I watched it again a few years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because the – specific moments in it to me are still just as good.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a lot of dead time with character development that doesn't really need to happen and all that stuff.
Yeah,
just it was made at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the steampunky Victorian era, you know, submarine is incredible.
Yeah, the Nautilus, yeah,
it is
great.
Absolutely stunningly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you see it, the fact that, you know, they made this and this is a movie prop in essence,
yeah.
But it's just like, wow, the amount of detail and beauty and like the underwater divers and certain aspects of it are just as fascinating today. Like when we're, doing a search of this for this list.
Yeah.
I already had like a decent amount, but I was like, is there anything that I'm missing?
Right.
And I found some arcane movies that I've never heard of. And just some of the posters of like, that would make a great movie today.
Yeah.
Where you could do it with real CGI and whatnot.
Well, Voice of the Bottom of the Sea. That's one I couldn't put it on the list, but it's one of those you're talking about from like the 60s. And it's like, this is interesting. If you could do it now with the technology we have now, it could be fun. The problem is that most times underwater movies don't make a lot of money. So they rarely make a lot of money. So that's why you
it's
got to
have
them.
A big shark or submarines fighting.
Yeah.
That's why I was surprised of not a lot of just straight deep sea exploration.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you're going to run into, and I guess it makes sense, but you're going to run into the Meg or something like that.
Or even documentaries if you want to start opening that door.
True.
There are some underwater documentaries that were released as films, like the James Cameron one where he's going after the Titanic and stuff of that nature. Yeah. Richard Fleischer directed this one too. And two of his last films were Red Sonja and Conan the Destroyer. So my man had some interesting – Soylent Green. Did Soylent Green?
Sure.
I like that. He did Tora. The Boston Strangler, that one with Tony Curtis where he plays the Boston Strangler.
Never saw that.
The Vikings. Yeah. Some interesting choices there for Richard Fleischer as a director, but certainly lives quite some time before he left this world in 2006. All right. Where are we at? What's number four?
My number four is Finding Nemo.
All right. It's a punt.
Okay.
My number four is The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Yeah, it was another, to me, sub-movie, and I had enough sub-movies.
Okay, fair.
So
if you're going to take off Hunt, I got to leave this one on. And we rarely talk about this one.
Yeah, no, this doesn't come up all that often.
Right.
I haven't seen it since the initial time that I saw it.
Oh, wow. Well, I just bought it on Criterion when it's the 50% sale that was happening, and I watched it again. Not my favorite Wes Anderson movie, certainly, but I think I enjoyed it more this time, way more this time, than I did when I initially watched it. Because when I went in to see it, it was right on the heels of Tenenbaums and Rushmore. Mm-hmm. So you think it's going to be one of these quirky kind of films about a submarine and family. But it's actually kind of super fucking dark in certain moments.
Okay.
And also weird. And weird in a way that's
weird, for sure.
Yeah, right? And weird that isn't cute. It's weird in a way that's like dangerous or unsettling.
Okay.
The Willem Dafoe character is like, you just don't know what's going on here. Is this a pseudo-homosexual relationship? Because his uber attachment to Bill Murray. What's the deal here? Owen Wilson is initially presented as some kind of antagonist or gold digger, and then you realize, no, he's actually this dude's son, and he's really trying to figure out how to make a connection. Then you have Cate Blanchett as the reporter, and then she gets impregnated by Owen Wilson. So that adds another level to the responsibility situation. And then Bill Murray himself as just like this kind of like really irresponsible SOB who has no semblance of self-reflection or self-awareness. So it's kind of interesting decisions all around. Goldblum's great. Of course, Angelica Houston's fantastic. So but I just thought I'd throw it because we haven't talked about it in a long time. We haven't talked about it rarely ever. So, but it's a good damn movie. It's just unusual in the Wes Anderson oeuvre.
I wish I had more to. I mean, what I remember from it is like the cut of the boat cut in half, so you could kind of follow along as almost like a dollhouse type of thing. It was super interesting and a lot of the quirkiness of the wildlife or the aquatic life that they're going after and whatnot, and the red hats and
the red hats, right?
Like certain things pop off for me, but I have not seen it in its entirety.
Okay.
And what year did that come out? 2002?
Oh, good question.
2003?
Probably.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a bit. I know it's been a bit. Maybe even 2004.
2004.
Yeah. Bill Murray, Owen Wilson. Yeah. A lot of people in this thing. Michael Gambone, Noah Taylor. All right. Anyway, where are we at now with you?
So that was your four?
That's my four.
My three is one you just alluded to.
Ooh.
And it's one that I said that could be maybe breaking the rules a little bit here.
Okay.
Ghosts of the Abyss. The James Cameron Titanic.
All right. Not on my list. Knock yourself out.
Well, okay. So when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And you were in your, late 20s.
Shut your mouth.
I'm sorry. Early 30s? What was it? I'm not entirely sure. I had just gotten out of diapers.
What century are we talking about?
But anyways, the lead up and build up to Titanic and Dr. Baird going back and searching for – I was thoroughly fascinated. I did a science fair thing on it, and I read a bunch of books, And I was fully enraptured with everything else that was in pop culture at that point. But then I just kind of went deeper. And I loved all the pictures and images and everything that I got to see from it. And this, they go down and the technology's gotten even better. And like the little unmanned rovers they could shoot off from the subs have gotten even better. And they go into and you can see the depths and certain aspects of what still remains. And I found that utterly fascinating. Like they found the interior of this door, first class passengers as they walked onto the boat. They came through these specific bulkheads.
Right.
But nobody had any records of what that actually looked like. Just the interior room, the ante room when they first came in.
Right.
And they pull in and they see these wrought iron doors that nobody knew existed until this very moment. And they're like, oh, so then they could, you know, posit what this small little interior room, they know what is, because basically it's kind of like you know, when you walk into a sporting event and you hit security first and then you get let in, that's almost like this. You walk into a small room before you go into a main area.
Yeah.
They funnel in, but they didn't know. And you see, like, these lead glass that is still intact after having gone down over 2 miles straight to the bottom of the ocean.
Right, right, right.
And just to see something this – it's eerie to watch – as they pass by all these man-made things that had been sitting in a grave on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean for lo these many decades. And I was just utterly fascinated by it. There are certain aspects of it where – so they have Bill Paxton.
Yeah.
He's the – basically – he is us.
Yeah.
Cameron plucks him to basically be the stand-in for the audience, and he's experiencing all of this and going down and asking questions. And he's got like a Russian sub operator with him. And at some points, like, he's asking questions like, what do we do if this happens while they're down there? And the guy's like, you know, we do this. But he has to so that you inform the audience.
Yeah.
But the guy's like, you know, like.
He's like, what's this way from Armageddon? I've been on the ship too long and with this, with hit with pipe. This is simple.
Oh, they have that at one point. Like, they're fixing something and they just pop down this little thing of screwdrivers. And you're like, wow, that's kind of scary. That you would have to tighten a bolt or something a couple miles underneath with all that pressure and whatnot.
Yeah.
And there are some moments where they're looking through portholes. And I have to assume they shot that somewhere else.
Right.
Because so Cameron set up his sub? Because they had two subs down there
at
the bottom. So you're saying they set up their sub to look back at his so they could get these shots?
Right.
Seems kind of like a waste of everybody's time, resources while you're at the bottom of the frickin' ocean.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is just utterly fascinating for someone that, you know, for a couple years of my life, I read a ton about this
and
was fully enraptured with the idea of this massive, you know, man-made thing at the bottom of the ocean that was supposed to be indestructible and unsinkable. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they find like what they think is Molly Brown's cabin. And they find, you know, all these little interesting things. Like, I already knew the grand staircase, but now that you can descend within that, and the first time they can go on lower decks, you go down and explore down there. And it was just for that aspect. And then they do little recreations that they project onto, like, here's the main steerage area. The frickin' called. But then they kind of project these ghost-like figures on, and they recreate the moments of the accident.
Right.
Just in short little bursts, and it makes it even spookier.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating.
Yeah, okay. I dig it. All right, that's your number three?
That's my three.
My three is The Poseidon Adventure, which is your pun from earlier. Still one of the best films from the 70s for me. I think Gene Hackman – if Gene Hackman's not in this movie, this film doesn't have anywhere near the – I don't know what you call it. The gravitas that the film has – for it's just the ship gets turned over in an underwater tragedy, and they have to find their way to the bottom of the boat, which is now on top of the water, so that they can knock on it and get heard by the rescue team that's coming in with a helicopter. It's New Year's Eve or Christmas, I think.
It's Christmas.
It's Christmas.
They have to climb up that tree.
Right, right. So it's Christmas, and they're on the ship, and then you get introduced to all these characters, right? And initially, it's Gene Hackman and Rob Shelley Winters. So many red buttons, I think. So many interesting people are involved in here. Ernest Borgnine. And then you start to hear their, like, stories, their issues, their whatever. So they lay the groundwork, you know. Mm-hmm. One is scared to be on a ship, on the water in a ship, blah, blah, blah. The other one is, you know, trying to figure out their marriage, if they're going to make it work. And Gene Hackman's having a religious crisis of conscience, an existential crisis.
Well, he's a priest.
Yeah, he's a priest, but he's trying to figure out if he should be a priest anymore because of what's going on in the world. He feels like hopeless about it. He doesn't know if he's doing any good. So as all this stuff happens, then the ship capsizes because I think that's a wave that that pushes him over.
Yeah,
a rogue wave
so.
Or something like that. And so, which is great visuals, by the way, when the ship gets capsized. The visuals, like you said, the visuals of just the guy falling through the stained glass window, mm-hmm. then them climbing up the Christmas tree to get off the bottom of the top of the ship, which is essentially the bottom of the ship now, to climb back out, and then all the different people who are walking through the ship trying to figure out their own way to the bottom of the ship, which is the top of the ship. It's fantastic. And then all the deaths that happen along the way.
And there's no specific rhyme or reason to the deaths.
No.
Which I think is great. Yeah, makes it more impactful and believable.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah, sometimes it's just random. It's wrong place, wrong time. There was nothing. It's not like this person was an asshole at the end of Act 1.
Right.
So you know by the end of Act 2, beginning of Act 3, that they're dead or whatnot.
Right.
It's like,
right.
No, that was a good character, and they're just gone.
It's like heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, mm-hmm. too, when some of the people that – when they pass and some of the reactions, too. I mean, fuck. Borgnine's reaction is incredible so much. Edward Albert's reaction is incredible as well. So you get so much of this, and then Hackman's struggle throughout the whole film to the point right at the end where he's yelling at God. He's essentially raging at God. And this is like a 70s, disaster movie having this kind of element to it, which I thought was brilliant. Mm-hmm. So it's one I always go back to. And that sequel is a piece of dog shit. Don't ever see that sequel or the remake, rather. It's horrific.
Yeah, it is not good.
No. I mean, Richard Dreyfuss plays the whole movie trying to kill himself before the wave happens. And after the wave happens, he wants to live. And other people die so that he can live. Fuck that noise. Anyway, all right. What's your number two? Or do you want to talk about it? Do you want to say?
No. Okay. I think you fully summated. I don't think we have anything to add to that. Poseidon Adventure is awesome. Please see it if you've never seen it. It's definitely worth it of the, 70s.
Yeah. And then, disaster film.
Disaster film.
That one in Towering Inferno.
My two is probably your one.
Okay.
The Abyss.
Yes.
Okay.
Good guess.
Yeah. I only have one above that. The Abyss is dope.
Let me guess.
The Abyss is dope.
It is dope. Soup's dope.
The effects, I think that's the most impressive part, still hold up.
Yeah.
I know I went back and just rewatched the specific water little tendril finger thing that comes through. Still fully effective to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting now looking back because I loved it as a kid and I still love the movie, but that it's these underwater aliens is ultimately where it kind of ends up.
Yeah.
It's such a weird choice.
Where it lands, yeah.
Yeah, and like it comes up and it lifts all the ships up type of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, this is super, super weird that this was the choice, but I like it.
Yeah, the original cut doesn't make that moment work. The director's cut does. You have way more explanation about what's going on down there, why they were down there, and how long they've been down there, and what they've been waiting for. So when they come up, it's supposed to be a powerful symbol of trying to bring the world together and show and trying to like have some peace. And you do get that in the original cut, but it's more validated with the director's cut.
Okay.
But yes, agreed. The special effects still work, but it's all of that is great. But it's really the story between Ed Master Antonio and Ed Harris, that relationship.
Oh, when he's pounding on her chest,
right.
So visceral.
Yeah.
And he gets saved by his wedding ring.
Yes.
Trying to get through the door. That's strong enough.
Of all things.
Right. Something that he was willing to throw away is now going to save him.
Yeah.
And I love that. Look, if you're going to do something like that, that is, what is that, a metaphor?
Yeah.
For his current situation, that which you threw away is what saves you.
Yeah.
But to see it, represented like that on film, that's beautiful. Cinema.
Agreed. It's symbolic, right? Because the ring also symbolizes that the marriage is stronger than you think.
Yeah. There you go. Symbolism as opposed to metaphor.
Yeah. And I love it. All of it. And the two best scenes are her death scene is incredible. Some phenomenal acting.
When she has to make the choice of you're the stronger swimmer.
Yeah.
And he realizes that's – yes.
Yeah. And he hates that – but he has to watch his wife die in front of him. Mm-hmm. Drown in front of him. And the reaction is incredible. Then you have that gap of time where he's bringing the body back, and then him bringing her back to life is an incredible scene as well. So it's the whole movie is about this marriage, and if it can be saved, and it stands for humanity and the earth. Mm-hmm. Can it be saved? You know, so I just think there's so much going on in the abyss, and they do not, and only there's like a strong contingent of fans who worship and love the abyss and understand how great of a film it is. And so many other people are more about Terminator or Aliens or other shit. But this is the one that I always come back to as my—
What is it, James Cameron?
Yeah, like my favorite Cameron. I think it's might be my number one favorite Cameron. Yeah, it might be.
You're up against T2.
That's what I mean. I don't like T2 as much as one because Furlong annoys the piss out of me the whole fucking movie.
Yeah,
no one annoys me in Abyss. No one. Not even that stupid dude with the fucking mouse.
No, he's good.
Yeah, he's good
Michael
at what
Biehn,
he is.
Michael Biehn is really
good.
Oh,
Michael Biehn's great. When he gets the bends, man, he works that mustache.
Self-mutilation, where he's cutting himself. You can tell he's fully unhinged.
Yep.
Yeah, that's quality. It's a quality movie.
Yeah, good stuff. And it's an expansive film. And, you know, when Ed Harris goes down there, the communication between him and Mastantonio is very moving as well. So there's a lot to enjoy. And then randomly, Chris Elliott's in this damn thing, too. Anyway, all right.
So your two is a punt from earlier.
Finding Nemo.
Finding Nemo.
Yeah, that's a— it's an untouchable film.
Yeah, it's an all-timer.
Right?
It's an all-timer.
You could argue it rivals Toy Story, in my opinion. You could argue—
What, the original?
Yes.
I think it's better than the original.
You think it's better than the original Toy Story? Do you think it's better than— Oh, you don't think it's better than Toy Story 3? Or what's your favorite Toy Story?
Toy Story 3 is my favorite. It's not even close.
Okay.
It probably goes 3-1-2-4.
That's fair. Yeah, I think that's about right. I think I would agree with you on that.
Just overall. But, like, favorite Pixar's, I still have reverence for Toy Story because without that, there is none of these others. Finding Nemo versus Toy Story 3, I think I give a slight edge to Toy Story 3.
It's a tough fight, though.
Oh, no, it's good.
The fact that it's a tough fight says all you need to say about Finding Nemo. Yeah.
Well, just the bond between father and son and how strong that is and the loss of the mother.
Yeah.
And it has weight and impact, and yet we don't need to see it.
Right.
The implication is more than enough for us to feel, you know, their pain.
Yeah. The after effects are what we—
Yeah, the reverberations where he doesn't want him to explore out there.
Right.
The take one step out, two steps back type of thing as he's, you know, the world is a scary place type of deal.
Yeah. Because both of them on their journey— Marlin is selfishly wanting to keep Nemo close because he lost his wife. Mm-hmm. And Nemo naturally wants to push the boundaries. That's what kids do. But pushes it in such a scary way. And in the end, they both go on their own journeys of discovery and maturation and processing the loss. You know, because Nemo's pushing out because Nemo's tired of being kept under protection by his dad. He wants to kind of spread his wings a little bit or spread his fins a little bit.
Yeah.
But what he discovers about when he meets different people, especially in that aquarium, in the whatever you call that, the fish tank, he is like—
Oh, the dentist's office?
Yeah, in the dentist's office. Like, he's talking to all these different kind of characters, and it's, in essence, a way opening up his world, right, from what he's known in that reef. There's so much more out there, so much more experiences, different kind of people who've lived in this world, have suffered and have literal scars from their suffering, you know, all of that. He grows as a kid. And Marlin grows as a dad as he discovers, like, there are dads who are cool with their kids floating out and doing their thing because their kids are going to come back.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I love that. All right. So then what's your number one?
One is Das Boot.
Okay. Knock Yourself Out.
Yeah. It's one of the best war films. It's a taut thrill. It is long.
Yeah.
For those that look at the runtime and basically don't feel as though they can sit through something that is that length, it flies by.
Yeah.
Just because the character interactions are so good. And please, as we've said before, watch it with the subtitles.
Yes.
It's much better because you get the intonation and the emoting from the German actors.
Yes.
And it really conveys what they're trying to get across to the audience.
Yeah.
When you see voiceover, it just kind of kills the momentum of a bunch of different scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It just sucks. So please see it with the subtitles.
Yeah.
I can't think of a single movie that is any good that has subtitles where the dubbed version is actually as good or better.
I don't know a dubbed version of a movie that's better than the subtitles.
Better's tough. Is as good, I think, is a better metric.
Okay.
Can you think of—
Well, I know the Batman Ninja came out, and it had the subtitles corresponded with the English dub. But the English dub doesn't—
A match up to—
Right. Doesn't authentically dub what is being said in Japanese.
Okay.
So that's the frustrating part of it. So I watched it with the Japanese audio and English subtitles so that I could see the authenticity of their reactions to things and hear the audio and what they're doing and try to get what they're talking about. And then like the English sub like filled in what the story was overall. So that was the way I watched it. I still have never seen the Japanese authentically dubbed into English. They dubbed the English English audio into subtitles. So.
Okay.
But yeah, it's rare.
Yeah.
It's rare. Like Akira doesn't work with the dub. It's terrible for Akira. Oh my God. You've got to watch the subtitles. It's so much better. What else were you saying about this film? Oh, I'll give you this. the other night when I was mentioning Lindley what the subjects were for Top 10, I go, we'll do an underwater movie. She goes, oh, Das Boot's number one. I had no idea she'd even seen his goddamn movie.
It's best.
So it's pretty phenomenal. She was surprised that I wasn't going to put it number one. So
I remember, what was it, last, whenever we did sub-movies, yeah. which was last year at some point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And right after that, was hanging out with a bunch of family and the random discussion of, and it's on Catherine's side.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many of them know that we do this.
Okay.
You know, type of thing.
Right, right, right.
And then literally someone was like, oh, you know, sub-movies. Are there any good sub-movies? And in my head, I was like, oh, there's so many good sub-movies. But I was like, well, you need to do yourself a favor if you've never seen any of them and watch Das Boot. And another gentleman who I've only had sparing interactions uh-huh. instantly looked at me and was like, dude, Das Boot is so good. And I'm like, it's one of the best.
Yeah.
It's one of you need to see it. And it's like, after that, I can go through. There's the Crimson Tides, the Black Seas,
right.
the, you know, Hunt for Red Octobers, Run Silent, Run Deep. Like, there's a whole bunch after that. There's been a lot of sub-movies.
Certainly.
But Das Boot is just pitch perfect. Is you see the idealism and then you see the harrowing effects of what war is and living on this boat and living in a perpetual state of fear.
Yeah.
You want to talk about PTSD. I can't imagine living in a metal tube where you're under constant fear of being depth charged and destroyed at all times. And regardless of what side of the conflict you're on, any human being that's in that situation, that is brutal psychologically.
Yeah.
I don't know how anybody signs up for that one.
Yeah.
Carrier, destroyer, all the rest of it, battleship makes way more sense to me than sub.
Yeah.
Do they get extra pay?
I don't know, actually, because I never served on that side of things. But maybe.
I got a cousin in the Navy. I'll ask him.
Some people just like serving in a sub or being a
true.
Part of it.
There are going to be those, but there have to be some that get assigned.
Yeah, right. Of course. Yes, of course.
So.
And what sub do they get assigned to? And you really can't go anywhere. Like, you're stuck in that thing 4 months.
Yep.
You know, whatever issues you have with people, whatever issues you have with your superior officers, you have to learn to navigate it.
Just living in a metal tube of farts. Yes. Can you imagine, like, the World War II? At least now they'd have air scrubbers and they try and make it better.
Sure.
Then you're just living with other people's BO and farts.
You're just living
for
with it.
Months.
That's what you get PTSD from.
Oh, that's just the smell. They open up that hatch, just birds die that are flying over.
Or if it overflows. Into the like the toilet overflows in the sub. Oh, game over, man.
That actually might be a breath of fresh air compared to the stink. I mean, how often do you think they got the shower?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and as Matt said, the watch the original audio with the subtitles, but also watch the cut, the director's cut. Watch the longer cut.
Oh yeah, the longer the better.
The longer is just such a better experience, and it will go by quick. You will not feel it at all. It's incredible. So. And Jürgen Prochnow is fantastic. It makes you remember why he was cast in so many films in the 80s on both sides of the continent.
Yeah, now he gets just smaller parts here and there.
It's always nice good. When he shows up. It's always nice.
He's always good, but he's done a lot of shit films.
Yeah, well, he has to stay alive. Like Udo Kier, good actor, but shows up in a lot of shit. All right, well, that's our separate top 10 underwater movies. Should we list them out for Cody and Adam?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, my list first. At 10, I've got Finding Dory, 9, Sphere, 8, Atlantis, The Lost Empire, 7, Crimson Tide, 6, The Poseidon Adventure, 5, Black Sea, 4, Finding Nemo, 3, Ghosts of the Abyss, 2, The Abyss, and number 1, Das Boot.
Wow, Das Boot. So my number 10, after adjustment, is Atlantis, The Lost Empire, 9, Finding Dory, 8, Crimson Tide, 7, Black Sea, 6, Das Boot, 5, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Number 4, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. The Poseidon Adventure at number 3. And number 2 is Finding Nemo. And my number one underwater movie is The Abyss. So now we're going to put these things together. Matt, I will grab the bongos.
Okay. I think I've got 3, 6 versus Where did he have Das Boot? He had it at one, did he not? I don't remember. Anyway, get those tickets, guys. We make an effort to come to your town. We can't wait to meet and see all of you. We're going to put on a hell of a show. London, don't forget, we had mentioned it in previous episodes, but we hadn't done on this one. We have the room for longer than your average show, so we intend on going extra. So we're talking about potentially doing a Q&A or figuring out some sort of added bonus on top of a regular show. But because we could only do the one show in that venue, we asked and received a longer runtime. So the doors are open at 7, the show's at 8, and we have the room until 10:30. We got to get everybody out by 11, so we're ending at 10:30. Mm-hmm. But so where did you have Das Boot?
I had a number 6. Okay. Right? Yeah.
So this is how I see the list shaking out.
Okay.
I have The Abyss at number 1.
That's fair.
Finding Nemo at 2.
Okay.
Das Boot at 3.
All right.
Poseidon Adventure at 4.
Okay.
And then where'd you have Black Sea again?
Number 7.
So 5-7 versus Crimson Tide was what?
8.
7-8. Yeah, okay. So Black Sea.
Okay.
And then the only other, so we have.
And then Finding Dory in Atlantis.
Finding Dory in Atlantis. I guess we could just do that. So you had Finding Dory at 9 now?
At 9, yeah.
I got that at 10, so, and then we have 8-10 for Atlantis. All right, so we'll do Atlantis, The Lost Empire, and then Finding Dory. What's your next highest then?
Number 4 with Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Okay, I got Ghosts of the Abyss at 3. So we're going to go with Ghosts of the Abyss. Okay. And then The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
Wow. All right. Let's count this list down. The top 10 underwater movies, At number 10.
The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
At number 9.
Ghosts of the Abyss.
At number 8.
Finding Dory.
At number 7.
Atlantis, The Lost Empire.
At number 6.
Crimson Tide.
At number 5.
Black Sea.
At number 4.
The Poseidon Adventure.
At number 3.
Das Boot.
At number 2.
Finding Nemo.
And our number 1 underwater movie is...
The Abyss.
The Abyss. Still not in 4K, which for some insane reason. For God's sakes, Cameron, figure this out.
He's kind of busy with Avatar 2, 3. How many of them are there?
5. I don't know. He's making like 4 of them. 3 or 4 at the same time.
It's like a ridiculous number.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's a little busy with that.
I guess so. Someone's got to figure this out, though. The thing needs to be out in 4K. You put Terminator 2 out in 4K, you can't put Abyss out in 4K? Come on. Figure this out. Anyway, all right, so that's our Top 10 Underwater Movies. Thank you so much for everyone for listening to this episode of the Top 10 Show. We always appreciate you downloading the episode, sharing it with your friends, tweeting about it, talking about it on the Facebook group. All of it means so much to us. And spreading the word, spreading the love. A lot of you need to retweet these shows, need to share these shows.
Please.
The more people come aboard, because here's how you got to look at it. No matter how many followers you have on social media or on Facebook or whatever, if you tweet about the show or share the show in any way, shape, or form, it's you putting your own personal stamp on the show for your friends to give it a chance. So we would like to do that. We want to keep expanding and building and building. We're in our, fifth year now for the top 10, and we want to keep growing. More and more live shows, more and more stuff to do, and we need your help to do that.
Yeah, I echo everything John just said. Please. You guys have always been great about it, and so we hope you don't lose the steam of retweeting it or liking it or responding or joining the facebook.com/groups/the top 10 show, all spelled out, and join the discussion there, or over, if you'd like to support us, at patreon.com/the top 10 with the number 10. You can do that there, and you can jump in on the – we have shout-outs and classic shows and shows specifically for Patreon and the re-list, and you can choose a topic, and there's all kinds of stuff. Plus, with Houston, we did advance – they got the jump on advance tickets a couple days early. We're trying – and we didn't know we had that ability until they offered it. And we're like, oh, great. We can give something to our patrons because they've supported us, so you get first crack at these tickets. So we try and cook up as many different things as we can for you guys because we appreciate your support no matter what it is. If you can't support on the Patreon, that's fine. Please just Let us know that you enjoy the show. Leave a review somewhere. Retweet it. Like a tweet. Respond to a tweet. Whatever the case is, we appreciate any and all support that we can get. And we're so thankful that you guys are here to join this journey with us in 2020. Yep. And thank you for an amazing 2019. We look forward to meeting all of you in person, wherever we're coming, here in the next year. And I think that is it for me this week.
There you go. Follow him at Matt Knows. Follow me at The Roka Says. And, of course, follow us on all – follow us on Twitter as well at Top 10 Show. And we will talk to you next time on The Top 10 Show.
Stay little Chico Pitbull, Mr. 305, better said Mr. Worldwide, and I'm here to tell you about my new podcast, From Negative to Positive, brought to you by my friends over at State Farm. I believe that to have success, you got to play the game so that the game doesn't play you. You know, the biggest risk you take is not taking one. It's very important that you make sure that you make the most out of your money, especially when it comes to insurance. State Farm offers surprisingly great rates. They have great agents standing by helping you personalize your coverage. All this is backed up by award-winning, easy-to-use technology. It's a great price with an even greater service. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
We begin today's meditation with a few sipping exercises to remind us a little treat can go a long way. So pick up your McCafe iced coffees, close your eyes, and deep sip in. And deep satisfaction out.
Take a treat retreat at McDonald's. Right now, get a McCafe iced coffee in any size and any flavor for just 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.